Miller's Netter, just talking to teachers.
Podcast pedagogy. What is Phil reading this week? Podcast pedagogy. Listening to teachers.
Naylor's Netter, just talking to teachers.
Naylor's Natter the Book. Ideas and advice from the collective wisdom of teachers. Naylor's Natter brings together a wealth of advice from the most influential voices in education today. In this exciting, one-of-a-kind book, Phil Naylor revisits the very best interviews from 3 years of education podcasting, drawing on the advice and opinions from some of the world's most innovative educators. Available now for pre-order from Amazon and out on July 7th, 2022.
So like, you don't have to wait for like the perfect conditions. We can tweak it and make it better, but like just get going is, I think, usually a good starting point. But what's interesting is the scarcest resource for me by far in education is time. Like, no one has enough of it. And therefore, anything I'm asking staff to do with their time, I want to be confident that there's a learning gain relative to the time spent. And the amount of time that people end up putting into PowerPoint animations, not only am I not convinced there's not a learning gain, but quite often I think there might even be a learning loss.
Talking to teachers about educational books, why we love them, and how we use them in our classrooms. With guest authors, publishers, podcasters, and of course, teachers.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Naylor's Natter. And the focus for today's conversation is the really exciting book. It's fresh on my desk, ready to go through. It is Teaching and Learning Illuminated, The Big Ideas Illustrated. And I'm thrilled to be joined by Bradley Bush. Welcome, Bradley.
Well, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure and a privilege to be invited on.
And I have listened to lots of your previous back catalogue. Like, oh, I have indeed, Brad. I have indeed. So I know that listeners will, and we'll signpost them to lots of those as well on the show notes. Right, let's get into it. So we haven't had to do one of these because I've been doing a lot of returning guests recently, listeners, as you know. But we're going to go back to tell us a little bit about you and your history education to this point, assuming that people haven't listened to all your back catalogue beforehand.
Okay, sure. So my name is Bradley. I'm a psychologist at Inner Drive. We run staff CPD training, both online and in person, and we also do lots of student workshops. So that's us as a company, I guess me personally. I taught in a college for a number of years while I was training to become a psychologist, and left teaching college. It sounds silly, but the honest reason why I left was I really wanted to see if I could be a part of one day helping England win the Football World Cup. So I really wanted to get into sports psychology and working with athletes, and then kind of fell back into education when I realised a lot of the stuff I was doing with my athletes wasn't based on sports psychology. It was based on educational psychology around how do we help develop good learners. And then I just became fascinated with learning as a concept and applying it into different domains, and the most obvious one being in schools.
Fantastic. Right, listener, you'll know that I'm not going to start going on to Bradley about my footballing past. I never, ever talk about it on the podcast, Bradley. Never mention my UEFA A license, do I, listener? Never, ever, ever.
We can do a separate pod about that if you like. That sounds way more fun.
Well, yeah. Well, as long as we don't talk about Wigan Athletic on current form, let's not mention that and the way things are going at the moment. Indeed. Right, let's get into it. So this is more than a book, listener. This is a thing of absolute beauty. You have to get this book in your hand to feel the quality. I mean, I read a lot of educational books and I have the privilege of being sent lots of educational books, but this one, I went straight out for the purchase. And this is, I mean, it's a read, it's a CPD manual, it's a coffee table book. The illustrations and everything in here is just the best I've ever seen. So I highly recommend this. But just tell the listener a little bit about what they will get, as well as all of that, from your new book, Teaching and Learning Illuminated.
Well, yeah, I mean, just thanks for the kind words. It's one of those things where, you know, when you work on something for ages and by the end you honestly have no idea if it's genius or if it's just terrible. And now it's released in the world. So it's generally lovely to thank you for the kind words. In terms of the book itself, when we did our last book, The Science of Learning, we really wanted it to be, we talked about it being like a Google Translate for research. So basically, can we take lots of psych jargon from research that's behind paywalls and just put it into plain English in our last book? And we kind of wanted to keep with that idea of making research accessible and understandable. And so if our last one was kind of Google Translate, we kind of say in the office, this book's basically Google Images. We wanted to take really kind of complex ideas, and we know there'll always be an oversimplification when you put it down in a graphic or in a diagram, but we want to see, can we just illustrate the core points from retrieval practice and cognitive load and metacognition, interleaving, all those kind of areas into just beautiful, almost art, basically. And I have to say, our publisher, Routledge, I'm amazed and just delighted with how much leeway they gave us to make it beautiful, to make it color, hardback. And we did want something that was going to sit on someone's coffee table. That's exactly what we're looking for. I always want to write a psych thesis, and one of my co-authors, Edward, he always wants to just do comic books. And so this was kind of our balance in between. And our third author, Lou, they just helped take my terrible sketches and actually make them aesthetically pleasing and add layers of complexity to it. So yeah, it was a real team effort, and we're delighted with how it came out. I guess the main thing for me is I think teaching and learning is really important, and it is a intellectually stimulating, and it's full of, you know, weight. And we wanted a resource that reflected that quality, that you're proud to have in your hands, felt nice to touch, and hopefully helps as well.
Well, it absolutely does. And like I said, I keep going, dipping back in and looking at different bits. And I am going to unpick some of my favourite sections as we go through. But as always, Brad, we like to leave the listener wanting more. So we're not going to go through everything. Not that we'd have time to go through everything this one, but we're going to leave them wanting more. So let's get into the book if we can. And I like the fact that you've started in one of the early chapters with four counterintuitive concepts on how we learn. So do you want to share some of those with the listener?
Yeah, well, that one was actually one of the things we love doing it in the drive. We generally love collaborating. We think there's a lot of really just intelligent, nice people out there that it's fun to collaborate with. And that one was prompted by the wonderful work, a blog by Sarah Cottingham, who anyone who's on Twitter, I think, is probably already following, because I think she talks about this stuff on such a great level. And she wrote this amazing blog around four kind of counterintuitive concepts. And yeah, just the content, the quality of her content was so good. It was quite easy to turn that into some graphical formula. I think one that out of the four that really strikes a chord for me is the difference now between learning and performance. I find that really interesting. So we do stuff like exit tickets and checking for understanding. And we hope we equate that snapshot in time with learning. Whereas actually, if we do go for the learning is a change to long-term memory kind of ideology, then actually we need to do this stuff regularly over time, because memories morph and fade and get distorted. And so we only know if someone's learned something over time, but yet we can be seduced into that short-term performance of thinking, I've taught it, they've repeated it back to me, tick. Whereas actually that's just quite a shallow processing of understanding. And so I thought that area of hers I thought was really good. The other one that I love is where she talks about the difference between just because you've taught it doesn't mean they've learned it in terms of their interpretation of what you said. And I know Sarah's got a book coming out in the In Action series that looks at theories of meaning, which I'd definitely prompt any of your readers, the listeners towards, because again, that concept of what's going on in the student mind being different to what I think it is, that difference is often where I think there's lost learning.
No, great, great stuff. Thanks, Brad. Thanks for that. So, right, I'm going to get into my little pet conversations now. So, again, I end up saying this all the time. I might have to cut some of this because I end up talking about myself. But one of the challenges in schools where there's a lot going on, let's put it that way, that I've euphemistically called them harder schools in my latest book. Okay. You know, some schools are harder than others. Shameless plug for that one again. But one of the things that we're often asked to do is to make, you know, pedagogical concepts consistent across classes to show that, you know, all teachers are kind of following the same pattern. All teachers are doing things that are recognizably similar, which has got its positives in terms of consistency for the students, but it's also got its downsides in terms of lethal mutations that come up. Yeah. Why am I mentioning all that? Because you talk very early on in the book about retrieval practice and its importance. And I think that a lot of secondary colleagues will recognize, you know, Doug Lamov's kind of Do Now as an opportunity for retrieval practice. So talk to us a little bit about the benefits of retrieval practice, and should it exist solely in that sort of 10-minute Do Now at the beginning of the lessons?
Sure. So in terms of the benefits, I know my reading of the research, I refer to it as primary and secondary benefits. So for me, the primary benefit of retrieval practice, consistently replicated, arguably the most consistently replicated thing out of most psychology, is that retrieval, if done successfully under the right conditions, can really accelerate learning. It can help ingrain information into long-term memory. So that for me is the primary benefit. Now, there are some really interesting secondary benefits which happen as a consequence probably of that first primary benefit. So for example, we know people who use retrieval tend to have a healthier relationship with feedback. It tends to go hand in hand with metacognition because you're more aware of what you do and don't know. There was a really nice study that we included in the book that found retrieval practice actually made students less stressed about upcoming exams. Because essentially, you didn't just improve their confidence, we improved their competence by doing so. And the reason I like that study and we want to include it in the book is because often these things get framed as academic interventions or pastoral interventions, like it's either or. And retrieval practice is primarily an academic one, but we can see as the secondary benefit, there are some well-being benefits as well. Now, in terms of your second question about as doing it as a do now activity, I should say I'm a huge fan of some of the work that Doug Lamov has done. I think it's really, really incredible. And I think retrieval at the start of the lesson is a brilliant route as an option to go down. It can get people settled, it can activate prior knowledge. So I think there's lots of benefits of doing it, and it's quite a natural time, I think, to do it. Where I see it going wrong and misconstrued is that doesn't have to be the only time that retrieval is done. And the format of it, you know, retrieval is not just about factual questions. When people say it only is like these five factual questions you do at the start of the lesson, then you often get subjects like art and English going, but how does this necessarily apply to us? For me, retrieval is actually conversation. You know, it's this back and forth, it's this questioning. It isn't an intervention as such. So yes, the beginning is a good time. Research suggests there are other good ways to start lessons as well. But doing it in the middle and the end, I think, can also be beneficial. The only real caveat I'd have to that is I was recently talking to Dr. Tom Perry, who was the lead author for the Education Endowment Foundation on the cognitive science report. And he was suggesting that having these set rules, like this dogma, like retrieval should be done right at the start, might be really good for novice teachers, because it can take you from being quite weak to having a rule-based approach. It can take you to maybe average. It's unlikely to take someone who's average and make them a brilliant teacher, because you need to know when to not follow the rule as such. So there might be a time and place, and I understand for senior leadership, they want that consistency. But in my experience, that consistency has to be balanced with giving teacher autonomy. Like, they are the expert of their classroom and they are trained professionals and we need to treat them as such. And having set rules that are never deviated, I don't think leads to informed autonomy.
No, it's a great point. And I guess if you put that kind of concept a bit more widely about the novice teacher, you know, you're suggesting that schools that perhaps, sorry, you're not suggesting, but you know, you could suggest that schools that are in difficult contexts, particularly in Ofsted categories or whatever, can be considered novices in teaching and learning if that's, you know, the way that they're looked at. So having consistency of approach across the board is a lot easier. Easier to quality assure, I suppose.
100%. And so like when I started, when I used to teach, like no one told me how I was meant to start. So I just did a range of different things. Some were good and some were bad. Whereas I didn't have the schema essentially in place to know what was going to be optimal. Someone giving me a structure to start with, so then over time I could then adapt, I think would have been very beneficial.
But you are right, and I had exactly the same conversation with one of the improvement partners that we're working with about what does this look like in PE. And, you know, he made a suggestion very similar to what you've said there, that retrieval practice might be a conversation in a changing room about three techniques from shot put that you did in the last lesson with your partner. That's activating prior learning, isn't it? That's retrieval practice. It doesn't have to be pencil and paper, four questions on a sheet. You know, you can do it that way.
100%. I think one of the biggest misconceptions around retrieval is either that it's just factual questions or that it has to be written down. In fact, when you actually look at the research around verbal versus written answers for retrieval, there's not much difference in terms of output. So it's more about what's right for your setting and your context. And I think the individual teacher is always going to be best placed to make that judgment as opposed to an external, a researcher or a psychologist.
But it is good. And again, this is why I recommend the book, listener, because then you can open the pages on that. You can look at that. You've got some handy diagrams, some summaries of the research, and you can look at that and dip in and go, right, you know, we're focusing on this, whether it's as an individual teacher or whether it's somebody who's leading on teaching and learning. You can very quickly have a look at that. And also, and I've done this already, Brad, you can have a conversation in the staff room if you ever get a chance as well. You know, have a look at this. What do you think about this? It gets people talking about those things.
And that's the thing, I think, with research. Research is really off-putting for some people. Like, it's behind paywalls and it's written in very psych-heavy jargon. Whereas if you have it in a visual form, like a diagram, you can at least debate it and it can open up a conversation. It doesn't say you have to follow it to the letter of the law, but at least means you're having more just professional conversations around teaching and learning, I think. It can be a good gateway.
Absolutely. Right. So when I used to do a little bit of work with a research school, Brad, one of the ones that I avoided going to was interleaving, because perhaps it's just me. I had so many misconceptions around interleaving. So I got all tied up and confused with interleaving subjects within a revision plan for students or interleaving subjects within a curriculum model. I also got confused about interleaving different concepts, say, because I teach science, say some biology, some chemistry, some physics within one lesson. So just talk to us a little bit about what interleaving you're referring to in the chapter you talk about it, and maybe some do's and don'ts of interleaving.
So the good news is you're in brilliant company. The number of schools I go into and everyone goes, right, retrieval practice, I understand that, makes sense. Spacing, yeah, like we forget stuff, so we should revisit. Again, no problems with that whatsoever. Out of all the areas of cognitive science, interleaving is the one that people, I think, rightly do find the most confusing. I did for a number of years as well. If anyone wants to read stuff that isn't in our book, two people who I've learned a lot from, Amabir Singh, I think he's written a brilliant book around Dunlosky's toolkit, which talks, it's one of the cleanest explanations I've seen of interleaving. And Dr. Jonathan Firth, he talks a lot on interleaving. Again, really clear and concise. Essentially, understanding, once you understand why interleaving works, it changes forever how you view it and use it. So the key to interleaving for me is what researchers call discrimination learning. So discrimination learning is aimed at being able to take things that are similar but different, and can you work out what are their similarities and how do they differ? So whereas spacing, you want to leave these kind of big gaps before you've almost forgotten them between things. Interleaving is you actually want to have them almost side by side, almost like an A-B, if you like. You know, how are these two things similar? How are these two things different? The famous example that I love to give is, if I was to ask you what was similar about Boris Johnson's last few weeks as Prime Minister compared to Liz Truss's last few weeks, what similarities are there? You might go, oh, neither one lost an election. They both kind of got forced out by their own party. Okay, that's a similarity. But then discrimination learning would go, but how do they differ? And you go, okay, well, one fired their chancellor, one had their chancellor resign. Okay, that's one difference. And by having them side by side, you're almost better able to spot the nuances and the differences between them, and you're more likely to remember them. So once you kind of know that discrimination learning is at the heart of interleaving, there are some obvious do's and don'ts. So one of the don'ts is you don't interleave subjects. So you don't go, right, I'll do French, then I'll do a bit of maths, do a bit of English, then a bit of French. Technically, that would probably be spacing, so it wouldn't be bad per se, but that's not interleaving. Interleaving is about concepts within a subject. So for example, you might interleave in basketball, in PE, a shot from the three-point line from a free throw, because they're both similar actions, but they are different. In art, you might look at works from different periods of time, because they're similar, but they're different. And so I think doing concepts, not subjects, I think is really good. I think the number of things we interleave is interesting. We don't know from the research an optimal number. Most of the research tends to look at three or four things as a maximum. And so I think about the numbers. And then the other thing I'd say about interleaving, my final reflection, I guess, really on it, is I don't think we should rush to interleaving. I actually think you need to do some blocking to start with. So going back to my Prime Minister example, I might need to teach about Boris Johnson for a few weeks and then Liz Truss for a few weeks before I then interleave. Because if I go straight to the interleaving and you have no base knowledge, it might feel like you're jumping around too much, and that might be a bit cognitively overloading. So once you kind of, as I say, get that clear about what it is and why it works, how we then use it helps. Because I used to think you could interleave a curriculum, whereas now I think you actually interleave within the lesson as opposed to the curriculum as a whole.
Yeah, that's really good, actually. And I'll remember the Boris Johnson and Liz Truss analogy. I think that's very helpful, actually. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if you taught Liz Truss's premiership, you could end up teaching it for longer than it actually occurred, couldn't you? That would be, that'd be quite interesting.
It's so funny. We used to do one of the experiments we used to do when we do our CPD. It's like a memory test, and we get people to name in 30 seconds five prime ministers. And then in the space of about 3 months, that experiment was a bit redundant because you could just do it all from your short-term memory, not your long-term memory.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Okay, then, right. Well, you mentioned in there, Brad, you mentioned about cognitive load. And cognitive load is another one that people probably, well, perhaps it's different to interleaving because people feel that it's become part of everyday language in a school or a staff room now. And everything and anything comes under the cognitive load theory, doesn't it? So, I mean, something as controversial, I suppose, particularly at primary school for primary colleagues, you know, displays on the wall. Well, we should take all displays down. Do you remember these Twitter spats and conversations about, you know, displays versus no displays? So tell us a little bit about how listeners, or how you suggest in the book, listeners can best use cognitive load theory in their classroom.
Sure. So I guess, just in case anyone, I guess, listening isn't aware, like cognitive load is, on its basic level, there are nuances, but on its basic level, because working memory gets overloaded so much because it's so small, that transfer to long-term memory doesn't often happen. And therefore, what can we do to help reduce that overload of working memory, essentially? The whole classroom display thing, I think, is really interesting because there's only a few studies. They're fairly small scale. They do show an impact that it can be distracting. But over time, the impact, though statistically significant, probably isn't going to be in your top 10 priorities, really, in terms of how we overload. If we're trying to minimize overload, I think stuff like redundancy effect is probably more of an issue. So redundancy effect says basically because working memory is so small, you don't know what's going to be filtered through. So you want to prioritize the key information. So, for example, if you've given instructions on the board and then verbally you're talking about something else, students have a choice. Do they see what's on the board and read it, or do they listen to you? One of the two ends up being redundant. How people use PowerPoint generally, like PowerPoint is a nightmare for cognitive load, I think, because it was never designed for long-term learning. Essentially, it was designed for short business meetings. Research shows excessive animations probably are redundant and lead to overload. The fact that the information is transient, once you go on to the next slide, that previous information has gone. And so therefore, I see a lot of people, probably because they're worried about accountability. Over the time, I've seen PowerPoint become a script. Like, we'll just put everything I'm going to say on the PowerPoint slides. Therefore, when I look back in the lessons, I can say that was covered. And yet, think about any CPD or any conference you've ever been to, Phil. No way is the one slide you remember the most the one with the most words. And yet, often we don't spend much time in training talking about how do we use PowerPoint and how do we manage cognitive load with it. So yeah, I find the classroom display stuff fascinating. We've blogged on it ourselves in the drive. But for me, if you're looking to minimize cognitive load, chances are, I'd say it wouldn't be in my top 10 probably.
No, and I agree with you on the PowerPoint. So I've done a bit of an experiment this year and I've just completely removed PowerPoint from any of my lessons. It wasn't like an ideological thing. It was just that I happened to have some booklets that I've been developing around the biology topics. And again, it was probably pragmatic, Brad, in terms of being a deputy head and teaching. And I know that my colleagues, if they are listening to this, and some of them do, believe it or not, they're going to say, well, you only teach once a day. You know, what do you know about teaching? But it was easier to have a booklet there so that when, you know, an issue happens, I've still got a lesson. I still have to interact with that. But the difference, and at first I thought, oh God, it's quite boring. This is quite dry. But then you're talking there about overload or cognitive load. If I'm going through something on the board and I'm highlighting key points from it and then we're summarizing it via diagrams, they're actually quite zoned in and quite tuned into what we're talking about there. And I have noticed much better concentration and much better retention of information over time from that rather than bells and whistles PowerPoints, which some of my other colleagues spend hours and hours and hours doing. And they'll impress me with these flying animations and hyperlinks and all of this. And I think I've just got some paper. Basically,
I mean, and to be honest, like, so we use PowerPoint quite a lot, and I like it when it's quite clean and quite simple and clear. But what's interesting is the scarcest resource for me by far in education is time. Like, no one has enough of it, and therefore anything I'm asking staff to do with their time, I want to be confident that there's a learning gain relative to the time spent. And the amount of time that people end up putting into PowerPoint animations, not only am I not convinced there's not a learning gain, quite often I think there might even be a learning loss. So it hits you twice. Because as I say, time is the powerful commodity. Someone recently described cognitive load to me is, they said you shouldn't talk about cognitive load. Essentially, it's easy if you think about it as attention overload, as a way of kind of getting your head around it, is attention is finite and there's only so much of it. So where are we directing their attention? And when you see it like that, then it's hard to make the case for all the bells and whistles or PowerPoint animation, I guess.
Excellent. Well, that's good news. So I don't have to spend all the summer putting some lovely 2003 clip art onto any of my PowerPoints. That's good news. Right. So we talked about cognitive load. We talk about cognitive science. Obviously, you're immersed in that world all the time. But I think a lot of teachers now, you know, thanks to you and other people that have written on this, and thanks to the kind of movement towards evidence-based teaching, I've got an awareness of cognitive science. And also, hopefully I've got this bit right, there was a big section on the Ofsted framework, wasn't there, that was written as a research review based on, I think it was Daniel Mers that wrote that, didn't he, about the kind of, so most teachers will be aware of that. So just share with us some mistakes that are easily avoided if you're using cognitive science in school.
Yeah, and so the Ofsted thing's interesting. So I always think, you know, obviously you shouldn't do stuff just for Ofsted. But having talked to schools internationally who don't have that sort of framework, you know, for all of its faults, the elements of cognitive science in the Ofsted framework, I think are, as a psychologist, it was amazing when I first read it. I'd never seen teaching and learning spoken about in that sort of ways, and it has driven the profession forward. So I think there's something good for that. I think in terms of general mistakes, I was talking recently to a retrieval researcher, and their gut feeling was, it's hard to do harm, really, with retrieval, is the first thing. So they're going, don't worry about perfection, essentially. Like, we know retrieval helps for students of all ages. There's some emerging research that helps send students for low prior attainment, high prior attainment. So like, you don't have to wait for, I think, the perfect conditions. We can tweak it and make it better, but like, just get going is, I think, usually a good starting point. Like, learn by doing. In terms of mistakes from cognitive science, I think dual coding is quite susceptible to mistakes in terms of, let's just plaster pictures on everything. I think from what I've read, as long as the pictures are very obvious what they relate to, so there's no ambiguity, so you don't want to use up cognitive load basically trying to work out why this picture's on your screen, that could probably help. So just to be aware of that. I think spacing is an interesting one. I often get asked, what's the optimal amount of time to leave for spacing when you're meant to revisit material? And I would love to come here and say it's 12 days the first time and 7 days the second round and all that kind of stuff. The research isn't there yet. We don't know what the optimal time is. There are some very rough guidelines, but I think as a rule of thumb, it's probably revisit stuff before students start to forget it. And that's why regular checking for understanding is probably really helpful. And going back to that earlier comment when I talked about Sarah Cottingham's blog around learning is over time, and therefore you need regular checking for understanding, so that allows you to then decide when to do your spacing. It's also, by the way, why I think stuff like Rosenstein's principles has become so popular, because although Rosenstein didn't explicitly talk about cognitive science, talking about weekly and monthly review, talking about checking for understanding, I think just goes hand in hand with where we are with cognitive science.
Yeah, absolutely. I was just thinking then as well. It's funny, isn't it? Because obviously, listener will be doing the same thing when you're listening to this and obviously reading the book. We spent about 5 minutes today trying to work out that my diagram for drug development was actually a willow tree. And I was trying to explain that this was aspirin from the bark of a willow tree. But like you said there, in terms of that kind of dual code idea, I tried to put a diagram there and they didn't know what the diagram was. So they might have known the information. They knew very well that it was, and again, scientists shout at the podcast, salicylic acid from the bark of a willow tree. It was just a very bad picture. And we were very confused for a long time on that. So yeah, you're right about dual coding with that one as well. And in terms of those mistakes, I think the book again addresses it really, really well at those things. And do you know what, as well? We all make those mistakes. Even the people that you see presenting at conferences and talking on Twitter, we all make these mistakes. And it's nice to have them out in the open and just say, look, none of us know everything. And I often sit in meetings, and you must, Brad, you must sit in them all, you know, with lots of people. And you think, they don't know what they're just using lots of words that sound like they've come from the Ofsted framework, but they don't really know what they mean. And if we're all a bit more honest about it, listeners, then we might be able to get a bit of a deeper understanding, might we?
Yeah, and but to be honest, like, so I'm quite relaxed around that because I think it'd be really easy to almost be a purist and go, but that's not exactly what the research says. And I know everyone's really worried about like lethal mutations, but for me, that's just part of that's trial and error. So research will never tell us all the answers because it's not done in your specific context. So it's always going to need a teacher to adapt it. And that adapting means trial and error. And part of that trial and error might mean a few lethal mutations. And you don't want them getting out of hand. But on the same basis, what I wouldn't want is people not engaging or not dipping their toe in the water because they think, if I can't do it perfectly, if I don't understand all the research, it's not for me. And the level of discourse now between 5 and 10 years ago around teaching and learning, I think is huge. And we're not there yet. And it's not finished, the work, but it's so much progress. So that's why I tend to be actually quite relaxed around when it doesn't all go perfectly. That's just where we are on the journey. And like in 5 years' time, we'll be better. That's just the nature of it, I think.
And that's why the book is good, because it does. It opens up those conversations. It gives you opportunities to say, you know, I don't fully understand this. Let's have a look at this. And also it opens up those mistakes that we all do make. And like I said, you know, I was nominally in charge of, supposed to be an assistant in charge of running a research school. I didn't have a clue what I was talking about half the time. You know, I just had to make sure that I was immersing myself in that and speaking to experts like yourself about this. So yeah, if you haven't dipped your toe in the water, then make sure you do. Right, good point to revisit, Brad, in the middle of this, to remind listeners that we're talking about Teaching and Learning Illuminated, The Big Ideas Illustrated. I'll say it. Go on, Brad, you were going to say.
Well, I was just going to say, no, but thanks for the plug. I didn't want to interrupt the plug there.
We're very slick. We're very slick professionals on this podcast. I've done about 160 of these. I know what I'm doing by now.
I mean, I was just going to say, going back to your point about mistakes being made, like, so I've got this current theory, and I don't know exactly how to word it, so I guess live on the podcast is as good a time as any. But my general theory at the moment is, like, no one knows anything for sure. Like, the researchers don't know. And like the classroom teacher practitioner like doesn't know anything for sure. We're all just guessing. And I think all this kind of research can do is help inform our guesses. But if we're saying the same thing in 5 years' time that we're saying now, I'd almost be disappointed. So kind of it's okay to kind of have that vulnerability of like, we're just guessing. I like the language of best bets or guidelines. People often ask me for like definitive, what's the best strategy for retrieval or what's the best way to start my lesson? And like, no one knows. We're all just guessing. And hopefully this can just sort of at least mean these guesses are based on something as opposed to just a hunch.
Definitely. Well, some of these best bets, as you rightly say there, and I think that was it Kevin Collins? He was one of those who used to talk about best bets, didn't he? Was about Rosenshine's principles of instruction. And, you know, as somebody who leads on the curriculum, one of the most challenging things is to try and temper teachers and curriculum leaders and phase leaders and key stage leaders' tendency to want to cover the curriculum as quickly as possible to get everything done. So is checking for understanding one of the most important of Rosenshine's principles? And, you know, in your opinion, is it done often enough and well enough? And what kind of tips could you give? So that's three questions in one there, Brad. Overloading the question.
So, I can't take credit for that. So we talk about it in the book, how we think it is the most important of all the principles, because it's basically the principle that underpins everything else. So you can't do scaffolding and modelling if you don't know where the current learner is. You don't know what to do for your weekly and monthly review if you haven't checked for understanding. It's hard to know when to give independent practice if you haven't checked for understanding. So for me, it underpins everything. I can't take the credit for that. That kind of came out, and there was a conversation on Twitter which someone said, I think they were inspired by one of Tom Sherrington's blogs about checking for understanding. And it was just a bit of a light bulb moment where when they said that to us and they thought it was the most important one, I was like, that's so right. Because when I reflect on my early practice, I just assumed way too much. I assumed that because I'd taught it, because I now know it, that therefore they had definitely learnt it. And there's a really interesting area of research called the curse of expertise, which basically says once you know something, it's really hard to remember what life was like before you knew it. So you kind of just assume that everyone has the same knowledge. And I think that curse of expertise is why checking for understanding is important. Again, how do we do it? The research can't tell us the best way. There are a number of different strategies. I think Doug Lamov talks brilliantly about them when he talks about ratio. cold calling, I think, is good. Mini whiteboards, think, pair, share. Again, we're seeing more and more research looking at why they're effective. Even wait times, I think, are quite key for checking for understanding. So I don't want to check your first answer. I really want to check that if you really know something, so it's not a race or a competition. So for me, it absolutely is the most important. We don't know the optimal way, and we don't even know how often we should be doing it. But that's not to say we don't know that it's not important.
No, absolutely. And like I said, one of the hardest things to change is, you know, teachers' tendency to want to get things covered and get things done. And actually, you know, like you said, you've illustrated three or four very quick ways there. I mean, cold call, obviously, it's not going to require a great deal of planning, although one of my pet projects at the moment is trying to plan questions in advance rather than just being a teacher of a sort of turn of millennium vintage where we just make up questions off the cuff. You know, we just say, oh, what do you think about that? And you think, no, think about your questions, Phil, first before you deliver them. So they can be quite quick, can't they, some of these check for understanding methods?
Oh, absolutely. And so I was talking to Doug Lamov the other day, and he was saying there's an amazing, once you dig under the surface, there's an amazing level of detail and nuance you can get into in the planning of cold calling, because essentially you want the students to get the answer right. You probably want to have an exemplar answer that you can refer back to, and all that stuff does take preparation and planning. Now, my co-author Edward, he used to be a major in the army, and he's got this phrase that he always talks about. He always says, no plan survives first contact. So he basically says you have a plan, but once the bullets start firing, everyone just runs off in crazy directions and like no one sticks to the plan. But you've got to have a plan to start with. And I kind of think that with questioning is you do have to have a plan. You do have to know what sort of areas you want to cover. But then that's, I guess, balanced with being flexible to meet the demands of the current situation as they arise.
Yeah, and I think, again, not just keep going about me, listener, so apologies, but you are listening to my podcast, so I've got to get my own views in
occasion. Yeah, you go for it.
Yeah, go for it. But one of this kind of time savers of the PowerPoint situation of not having to do all of that is that now you've got a booklet, and yes, it's a pre-prepared booklet based on the syllabus, but it does give you that opportunity to go, right, this particular task might lend itself to retrieval. Here's two or three of the questions that I'm going to use. I might not use them all. Here's a task then that's going to be a use for check for understanding. Here's where I'm going to use it. So I even write on it, I'm going to say check for understanding whiteboards at this point. And now that doesn't mean I have to do it that way. I might end up doing it cold call because, like you said, something happens or whatever it might be. But consciously thinking about questions, thinking about, you know, what methods of formative assessment you're going to use has been what I've used my lesson preparation time for now, instead of just making my PowerPoints look nice. And I've seen a massive difference in that. I think it's been really valuable.
I mean, and there's a whole, so we've got a chapter in the book on questions. So I think there's a whole layer of how do you ask high quality questions and how do you get high quality responses. I don't know if you've had a chance to read, I was very impressed with, I thought Michael Charles's book on, his recent book on questioning. I mean, we've just got a chapter on it. He's got a whole book on it. And it just goes, there's so much nuance of how do you deal with wrong answers? How do you deal with I don't knows? And all these things you can start to kind of tease out, and you actually realise that it's a whole section in itself, really, for teaching and learning.
Yeah, it is. It is. I haven't read that one yet. I've read his other ones, and I've spoken to him a couple of times. Yeah.
It's really good.
Yeah. No, he is. He's very, very good, and that's a good prompt, that. I'll make sure, make a note to get Michael Child back on. Right. Okay, then. So here's one that you can tell is another one of me asking, because I've heard this a lot recently. So, you know, the idea of independent tasks, so like an I do, we do, you do. So you get to the end of that. Lots of schools are now trying to make sure that a lot of these activities are done in silence, and it's kind of transferring across to, right, well, we've almost broken it down to, right, there's times when teachers input, that's when you should be sitting up, tracking the speaker, etc., and there's times when you should be working, and that should be done in silence. So do activities like turn and talk, pair share, do they still have a place? And kind of what's the cognitive science behind it? I know you alluded to it earlier, didn't you, with the retrieval practice. Are they still valuable activities to be doing?
Yeah, so I mean, there is some really interesting research around background noise. And obviously you get individual differences, but, you know, as a whole, generally speaking, background noise tends to compete for attention when people are doing a task. So it is quite hard. The example we always give is when you're driving, you kind of know you can talk to someone and have the radio on, but when you're lost and you need to think hard, you kind of generally need silence. So like, we know it can help. That being said, there was a really beautiful paper recently around think, pair, share that looked at you know, how do you get, what are the benefits of it, both in terms of students' attention and engagement, but also in terms of learning as well. And it was significant. Likewise, I think there is clearly a growing interest in oracy, and we can see it has multiple benefits. So if you can talk clearly and articulately, you're allowed to retrieve in more depth and more detail. I think from a well-being perspective, being able to label your emotions is really beneficial as well. So I think there is definitely a place for group work, think, pair, share, turn and talk, call it what you like. I guess the challenge that I've come across anecdotally and also I guess from the research is group work can be very, very tricky to do successfully because it tends to be dominated by the loudest, the quickest, smartest, which is why things like cold calling actually really help. Because it means, you know, you can guard against that. But if it's done well, there is some research that says group work can actually help manage cognitive overload because essentially each person thinks of a component part and you can build on each other's. So I think there definitely is a place for it, quite a big place for it, in fact. I just think it needs to be quite clearly structured.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I just think as well, obviously, there's been a proliferation of professional learning activities for teachers now, CPD, like MPQs, for example. And I'm on an excellent MPQH currently run by Ambition. And if you look at the questions and the amount of interactions that we have, I mean, I've just been on a learning community tonight where it was very tightly scripted. Right, tell us about your big challenge problem in school you've been working on all year. Talk to the person about this. And then there's four or five prompts of things you need to talk about there. And it does, it really, really helps. And I think that, you know, for students, as long as it's not that the kind of old fashioned turn and talk or, you know, just tell everybody what you know about this subject. Well, I might not know anything, or what I do know has got nothing to do with what we're talking about today. So as long as it's quite targeted, I found it really, really beneficial, Brad. And I found, you know, that the students respond to it really, really well. And it's nice to test out their kind of thinking without having to do it always front of the class. I do love cold call. But some people do freeze under cold call, don't they? Particularly when they're being tracked by the rest of the class. It's quite nice to have the opportunity to bounce it off your peers.
So the cold calling thing I find really interesting because we often get, I've been told by a number of schools and colleges this year that they're having more and more parents try and opt out their child for cold calling, mm-hmm. not based on a diagnosis, but just on, you know, they're a bit uncomfortable, they're a bit shy, they don't really like participating. And yet when you actually look at the research, schools that cold call, and you can do it in a warm way, but schools that cold call regularly actually leads to more students volunteering an answer because it doesn't become this big one-off event. It just becomes the norm. It's just how we participate, it's how we communicate in our classroom. And recently I heard Doug Lamov talk about it as it's just an invitation to join the discussion. And I think when you frame it like that, that's really nice because it suggests that everyone belongs in your classroom. And everyone's voice matters. So yeah, I think sometimes I see them done in contrast. It's cold call or think, pair, share, or it's cold call or mini whiteboards. I think we should always avoid dogma. Like it should never just be one. These are just options to have in the locker.
Yeah, absolutely. Tools in the toolkit. I remember when I spoke to Doug, probably about Christmas time about this, and I really enjoyed his latest book. I spoke to him about it, Reconnect. And yeah, I thought that he, you know, it's really good in terms of how he did explain that idea that track the speakers, important if it's a teacher, but it's also nice to track the speaker when it's one of your peers. And actually, at first you think, well, that's intimidating. I've got 20 odd sets of eyes on me. But, and I found this with our students. So, and, you know, praise to our students first. They were very encouraging. The looks and the support. And, you know, Doug talks about it in the schools that he saw where they've almost done some sort of physical gestures of support to show that they want to help. And it really has been. There's just the support and the kind of, you know, it has encouraged people to want to do cold call. So no, I still do very much use cold call.
Yes, I tell you what absolutely blew my mind when I was talking, because I interviewed him about cold calling. It generally blew my mind. I always thought cold call was really good for retrieval in terms of you don't know if you're going to be called upon, so therefore everyone's retrieving in case they are. And that is a big benefit, that is. But when he described it to me, that cold calling is actually really good to help developing listening skills, because essentially you don't know who's participating, who's going to be called upon, and you don't know if you're going to be called upon next to build on the previous person who's been cold called. So therefore, you have to really listen to their answer. So actually, it's just as much about the rest of the class as it is the person who's being cold called. I thought that was a really fascinating way of seeing the benefit of it.
Definitely. And we're very much in the Doug Lamov fan club, Brad, here, as he knows. You know, he's got, I do need to send him a football match ball because I promised him that after he'd been on three times, I promised him that he'd get a match ball for his
club. He's got the hat trick.
Yeah, but I've not got around to it yet. So sorry, Doug, if you're listening. I'm sure he isn't, but there we go. Right. Okay. Then this is, we just had half term. So goodness knows when this comes out. Hopefully, listener, it's going to come out pretty quickly after we've recorded this because I'm very excited about this one, as everybody at school knows. But I spent too much time, way, way too much time when the kids have not been here on my phone. I've been drawn down into my phone like never before last week. You know, cause it doesn't help that my football club are either going bust or getting taken over or something. So I've been tied to it. Right. The reason I mentioned that is you've done a nice section in the book about phones. And again, linked to Doug Lamov, his opinions on it are very clear. And, you know, I'm definitely in the camp of I wouldn't like to see phones at school at all. I wouldn't even like to see staff using phones at school, if I was quite honest as well, because it gives us a nice break from that. But I know that there's obviously pros and cons. So what are the negative impacts of phones on students, and what kind of suggestions might you give to people that, you know, are implementing policies and procedures at a school level based on any cognitive science that you've got?
Okay, so I'm going to go anecdotally and then talk about the research second, if that's all right. So anecdotally, the schools that I've gone into, the number of schools who've told me they've banned mobile phones or have a, if we see it out, we're going to confiscate it type policy. I am yet to have one school out of dozens and dozens and dozens tell me that since they've implemented that policy, not one school has gone, it was a mistake, or I wish we can go back to having phones. Like, every single one has said it's been transformational and has said the transformation has been quicker than they expected. Like, you have a week that's a bit turbulent at the start, and then it's amazing how quickly it becomes the new norm. So I would hardcore recommend banning phones in schools, partly because they don't use them to make phone calls. Like, we shouldn't call them mobile phones. Like, people use their phones to do gaming, social media, or access porn. Like, that's how most teenagers are using phones. So, like, to call them a phone, I think, is just branding. It's just PR for phones. What does the research say? A range of studies from around the world. So you can, like, in the book, we plotted it on a map just to show you just how universal it was. There is a strong either correlation or causation between schools that get rid of mobile phones and exam results getting higher. So again, from a pure academic achievement intervention, I think it's probably the quickest and one of the cheapest ways you can raise average student grades is by banning phones. From a well-being and pastoral side of things, we know that instances like bullying, safeguarding issues, going back to what we were talking about, oracy and communication, all these things are linked to kind of mobile phones. And for me, the research is pretty overwhelming. It's a slam dunk. And I think if I was starting from scratch with a blank piece of paper and I had a school policy, banning mobile phones would definitely be in my top five. I think it's just it's amazing how they've just crept in subtly over time. And it gets confusing in the research because sometimes in the research they talk about technology in the classroom, and sometimes technology can be a mobile phone. And sometimes technology can be a school-controlled iPad that has limited apps, which is a different beast. There's issues with that by itself. And I find the whole iPad and laptop stuff quite an interesting area. But certainly in terms of mobile phones, the link with it in grades is, I think, pretty much beyond doubt now.
No, that's really interesting. That was going to be the follow-up question. You kind of read my mind there with that one in terms of lots of schools have got mobile devices, policies, laptops, iPads, sort of Google Classroom, that sort of approach. So yeah. I'm always conscious as well that, you know, we're experiencing a lot of difficulties, aren't we, behaviour-wise, attendance-wise, punctuality and things like that following the pandemic, where essentially the only method for education was a mobile device. So it's been very hard to go from completely using that to now not using that at all. So what does the research say around sort of the use of technology in the classroom? Because I know, for example, in the EEF Send guide, that's one of the recommendations, isn't it, around the use of adaptive technology and things like that. So just tell us anything that you know about how you can successfully use technology.
So I think technology is very alluring. Is, you know, it looks like you're on the cutting edge. But again, earlier I talked about, is there a learning loss or a learning gain? So let's talk about the learning loss side of things first, I think. Research has shown, again, fairly consistently, that students who take notes on laptops versus those who do it by longhand tend to remember less. One of the reasons being because you can type faster than you can write. People tend to type word for word what you say as the teacher. So it's like a script, but that involves, like, it's very shallow processing of that information. Whereas because you have to be selective when you write by longhand, you think harder about the material. And it's also easier to make links between it. So from a memory perspective, I haven't seen any evidence that really suggests electronic note taking, for example, is better. There are some benefits. Obviously, you can save your work easier than notes getting crumpled in the bottom of your bag. It's easier to send the information electronically. So there are some gains. For me, the cost, I think, is something that's, I said time's the precious resource. Money's probably second on that list. And the cost of these interventions, pound for pound, I think they tend to be the most efficient use of money. But if money's no object, I guess that's fine. Where I've seen it work well, and where the research says what it works well, is when the device is closely controlled by the staff. So, for example, you're limiting what sites they can go on, you're limiting what apps they can go on, because, well, think of any conference you've ever been to, Phil. Even if you're really motivated to learn and you've paid money to be there, it's hard if your phone is out to not check it. And that's you as an adult with more self-control than your average teenager who's motivated, who's chosen by their own volition to be in that situation. So, yeah, if you are going to use it, I think using it, having a really clear policy on why you're using it. Sometimes I worry that people get the wrong way around in terms of they think, how can we use this technology? Which I think once you try and shoehorn technology in, it becomes problematic. Whereas the question should be, what problem is this solving? Once you go from there, and if technology is the answer, then we use it. But that answer has to be more time efficient and more cost efficient than just pen and paper. And I think that's the debate to be had.
Absolutely. So much in that. I mean, you think that, you know, sometimes teachers are the worst offenders for all these kind of things. So it quite often, I mean, I don't speak at, well, I have done quite a lot of conferences, but not recently. But you know, if you look at around, so you've got phones and you've got laptops and you've got all sorts going on, but particularly when teachers come out for the day, for a day's conference, with the worst offenders for this. I quite often start my staff meetings, and people seem to like it, with, you won't need your laptops today and you won't need your mobile phones. And there's an initial sort of, well, we're adults, you shouldn't really be speaking to us like that. But then then there's the second reaction is a bit of relief of going, oh, okay. Because that, you know, 100 emails that are in there, they're not important, are they? It's better that, you know, you've paid £100, whatever it is, to come out and listen to this. Rather than be trying to do phone, text, goodness knows what. It's crazy.
100%. Because I think that it comes down to, I think multitasking is a myth that we've all bought into that we can do. You know, I can listen to you talk and I can text and I can check emails. But stuff that matters, that requires deep concentration, singular focus is always going to trump multitasking. And basically, the problem with mobile phones and what you've described is, like, your brain and your willpower versus all the geniuses of Silicon Valley who are trying to get you to use your phone and use that app. Like, it's just not a fair fight. And it's one you're always going to lose.
No, completely. Right, Brad, I was conscious of time because we always want to leave the listeners wanting more. So there's a couple of quick questions to finish, if that's okay. So what I like towards the end of the book is you're talking about how you see this book being used. We've talked about the benefits and the advantages of the book at the beginning. And can I just say, by the way, again, for listeners, and, you know, I say this every week, but I'm not on any kind of commission for selling these books. You know, I get people on that I want to speak to about things that are useful for me in my job and hopefully they're useful for you in yours. But the price of this book is very, very reasonable, Brad, for the quality of the work.
Interesting, because we wrestled with it for ages because we told Routledge that we wanted to do it in a hardcover, like spot gloss finish, so it feels nice. And they said it would put the price up. We had this big debate and we were worried it was going to be too pricey. So that is generally lovely to hear.
No, it's because again, the listener will be bored of me saying I know a little bit, only a little bit about it. You know, I've done one book and I'm sure somebody's bought it somewhere. But one of the things I didn't put enough diagrams in there or anything like that. And I know, obviously, the format and everything like that. But the quality of this one You know, this is Thanks. Really, really high. So they've done some great work to keep that down at a very reasonable price, listener, which I won't insult Brad by saying now, but I'm sure you can find it on all the places he's going to tell you about in a minute. So when you talk about, you know, recommending this book to a colleague and kind of getting that momentum going where you say, oh, I've got this book. I've been using this in the classroom. What do you think about this? Lending the book to somebody else. So talk us a little bit about how people can use that book, you know, book clubs, recommend to colleagues, that sort of thing. And then just finish off with, tell us a little bit about where people can find out more about you, where you can find the book, where you can find you on social media, that sort of thing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, one of the things we really hoped was that people would just pass the book around. And I mean, in an ideal world, that senior leadership would buy a copy for all of their staff to have on their coffee table. We actually included a graphic in the book, almost in tongue in cheek, just to see if we could get away with it, because the whole book's about diagrams. So we included a pie chart, which has, you know, three quarters versus one quarter. And one of them was, should you recommend the book to a colleague? And three quarter was like, yes. And the other quarter was yes, but in yellow. And we were amazed that we were allowed to keep that in the book. So we'd like that we stuck that one in. Yeah, we just hope it kind of sparks discussion and debate. And we hope that people modify some of the graphics, I guess, to if it better suits their context. And just, as I say, I don't believe research has the answer. I believe it can inform judgment. And hopefully this just illuminates some of the research that we think is important and just puts it in a way that makes it accessible to as many people as possible.
Brilliant. And just signpost us, like I said, to your social media feeds, your website, where people can get in touch with you. Sure. And also, importantly, where the book's available as well.
Yeah. So our website's innerdrive.co.uk. If you didn't want to spend the money on the book, our publisher has allowed us to put a whole ton of it online for free. So feel free to cheat us out of royalties and go to our website to download as many as you can. Our social media is inner_drive. The book's available from Amazon and other good online book retailers. It would be lovely if you buy one, because it would probably double our sales, and you can join my mum as having bought my book. And yeah, just grateful for the people who've so far got in touch and said they enjoyed it. And it's just lovely to hear your kind words, Phil. I generally really appreciate it.
No. And like I said, it's genuine, because like I said, somebody leading on teaching and learning, I can't wait for these kind of books to come out. And I was straight on. That was one useful use of my phone last week, listener, when I actually contacted Brad and said, like, I need to get you on after a couple of days of flicking through. So it was really good. And don't believe his modesty. When I'm being modest, listener, about the sales of Nailers Natter, you can go and check it ranking on the Amazon. I'm being genuine. It's flying off the shelves, yours, Brad. It's flying off the shelves. I've just checked your rankings there. You're right at the top of the charts across the board. So, you know, it's going very well and well-deserved as well. It's really, really good. And I'm sure that, seriously, I'm sure a lot of senior leaders will. We regularly do that sort of thing and go out and buy the particular book of choice. So ensure that Doug's retiring off the royalties that he's getting from me in terms of all of his books, but other people as well.
In that case, if anyone does want to buy it for their staff, if you get in touch with us at our website at innerdrive.co.uk, hopefully we can persuade our publisher to give a bit of a group discount.
I'm sure they can. Right. Thank you, Brad. Really appreciate your time. Great to speak to you. And hopefully, you know, once I've used it for a year or so, and we can get back in touch, can't we, and give you an update on how it's going and how we're using it.
That'd be lovely. Thank you so much. And yeah, just thanks for having me on.
No problem. Thank you.
Nailers Natter, just talking to teachers.
Talking to teachers about academic research and evidence-based practice with continuing professional development at PNA 1977 on Twitter.
Nailers Natter, just talking to teachers.